Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman and welcome to The Love Code. Thank you once again for joining me here because this is a very special show. It really is designed to uplift, to help you transform, to access the healing power that you have, to connect you to your spiritual essence. And during these times especially, we really want to be able to connect, to find that place of peace, to be able to access the healing power that we have within us. So no matter what goes on in our world, we are able to sail through. We are centered. We know that we have access to a huge potential, huge power within us to guide us and heal us and transform our lives in positive ways. So thank you for joining me. And also, if you are listening for the first time and if you want to continue to receive these podcasts and also the other show that I do on Progressive Radio Network, which is called What Women Must Know, all you need to do is go to my Facebook page and like me there, and that's What Women Must Know. Or you can go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, and just opt in there, and those shows get sent out to you every week. So you can either check out the posts on my Facebook page, like me at What Women Must Know, or go to Dr. Cheryl Selman and opt in, and you'll get lots of great, not only shows, but all sorts of information and education that I send out on a regular basis. So those are some great options. And, you know, this is the time that we really want to be connected to places that uplift and inspire and educate us. So hope you'll be joining me with both of these shows, The Love Code and What Women Must Know, every week. So let's jump into a really wonderful and important conversation today. So we're going to be talking about how we can overcome times of high anxiety with my guest, Tara Henley. So a little bit about Tara. She is a Canadian broadcaster and writer whose new book, which is called Lean Out by Penguin Random House, just came out, shows how people are overcoming anxiety brought on by everything from COVID-19 to overwork. And Tara knows of this trend personally. What she thought of as a health crisis wasn't a cardiac event, but instead anxiety that told her it was time to slow down. What Tara then learned as she searched for answers can change how we look at the biggest issues of our time. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Tara Henley to the show today. So hello and welcome, Tara.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Obviously, this is an extremely important message that we are sharing with my audience, and just getting your book out there, sharing it with a wider audience. And it's the topic of anxiety. It's the topic of anxiety that is certainly the hallmark of our culture these days, but particularly this anxiety brought on by all these unknowns that have been initiated by this COVID-19 experience. There's so many unknowns. So many things have just been turned upside down. And that initiates so much anxiety for people when we are facing the unknown. So, before we go into the kind of meat and potatoes of your book, let's talk about you for a minute, because it sounds like you had an up-close and personal experience with the effects of being stressed, living in a, you know, obviously in a profession that's a broadcaster, you're under a tremendous amount of stress, and how it impacted you and your wake-up call, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was indeed a wake-up call. In 2016, I was in the newsroom and started having chest pains and was very alarmed, obviously, by that, and was compelled by my doctor to take time off work, which was the first real break that I had had in many, many years. I was working long hours. I was pushing really hard in my career. I had just moved to Vancouver from Toronto, trying to get a little bit of reprieve from the big city, kind of big career push. And I found it very disorienting taking time off. I was compelled by my doctor to take time off. I was on the couch for many months as I was going through the cardiac tests, which came back normal. It was anxiety. It was not cardiac. But the time in my life was very much like the time we're in right now. I was at home almost all the time. I was alone. I was very fearful for my health, and I was very worried about finances. And so that moment was very like, much like the moment we're in. And it really caused me to take a look, not just at my own anxiety, but the kind of epidemic of anxiety that we're dealing with in North America now. And I began to do research and reading and interviews, and that took me around the world and resulted in the book.
You know, it's pretty scary when at such a young age you think that you may be having a heart attack. That to me would be absolutely terrifying. It's like suddenly your world is turned upside down with this potential, you know, serious condition. How did you discern that it wasn't an actual cardiac event, but a stress-induced event?
I had a CT scan, and so my heart was, and a number of other tests, but my heart was completely normal. And so given the sort of stressful conditions that I was working in, the fact that I just moved across the country, I had moved to a city where we were in the middle of a housing crisis, and it was very difficult to find a place to live. So all of those factors made it clear that it was anxiety. And for me, the anxiety was so physical, it was very difficult to know that without going through the whole medical process and all of the tests. It was just I was not aware of the amount of stress and strain I was under, and the sort of mental aspect of it did not figure very prominently for me. It was a very physical manifestation of anxiety.
I had my own experience, it was many years ago now, but it was a really stressful time in my life, and I was working really hard and long hours, and I wasn't eating properly, and of course, I wasn't sleeping, and relationship tensions, and all of a sudden, I started to have these episodes where I would be waking up between 3 and 4 a.m. with high anxiety, palpitations, racing thoughts, fearful thoughts. And I never experienced that before, and I had no idea what was going on at the time. So I explored, you know, I was a psychotherapist back then, so I was exploring all these therapeutic tools because it must be some, you know, deep event in my past that was coming up, which, of course, didn't do the trick at all because it down the track after a year, I began to investigate this like yourself, and I realized, oh, my God, this is the stress response. When you get up at 3 a.m., 4 a.m. with a racing mind and palpitations, that is when you are dealing with extreme adrenal exhaustion. And then there were hormonal imbalances. And, you know, it took me some time to put all those pieces together to understand the role of stress, the role of adrenal exhaustion, and just how big a problem it is for people and how it shows up in so many ways. So, it was a big wake-up call for me, as it was for you. And it's still, of course, doctors didn't understand and probably still do not understand all the implications from anxiety, from blowing out those adrenal glands. And, you're offered, I don't know if you were, but often if you show up with anxiety, you're put on some sort of antidepressant or anti-anxiety medication, which, of course, is not solving the problem that your body is trying to get you to pay attention to. So it was a life-changing experience for me, Tara, because I had to reevaluate everything in my life to regenerate those systems. And it led me on a path of sharing this information with so many other people, just like you're doing. So I love that we're having this conversation again, because people really need to understand what's going on in their bodies that's affecting their emotions as well. So, So what are some of the key things that you uncovered in your exploration of understanding what was happening in your body that you have implemented in your life and that you're sharing in your book?
Well, there's a lot of different levels to it. The first was, of course, very physical. So I came to understand that my body was stuck in fight or flight. It was kind of stuck in that flooded with adrenaline, hypervigilant stage, and my body could not calm down from it. So interestingly, the chest pains continued for many months after I left the newsroom. My life was very relaxed at that point. I was sleeping a lot. I was eating nourishing food. I was going for long walks in the woods. I was doing the things you might imagine that I would do. I was going to meditation classes and exploring restorative yoga. And it took a very long time of doing all of that for my body to actually calm down. And so even 6 months into that process, I was still getting chest pains walking around my neighborhood or lying in bed reading or sitting with friends. So it was a very, very physical process. And it really made me understand that these processes are incredibly biological, and that in some ways, I mean, if you think about the crisis that we're in right now, anxiety is a very normal, natural response to that. We are under threat, and our bodies are responding to that threat. It's an invisible threat, and so it makes it very difficult to grapple with, but it is a threat, and it is normal to have anxiety. And so what I came to realize researching the book is that I was living in a very, very stressful society. I mean, if you look at the pollution levels that we live with, if you look at the noise that we live with on a daily basis, now that we're all slowing down and the streets are getting quiet and the air is getting clean, it's really, you can see the difference in such a dramatic way. But we live in a very, very stressful society. I was working in a very stressful job. And, you know, some of the bigger issues that I explored in the book, like income inequality and the impact that has on our health, it became really clear to me that anxiety was a normal and natural response to the society that we were living in. So first of all, I had to learn how to calm down my body. So I did a lot of the things that most people do. I did take meditation classes. I did restorative yoga, where you would lie kind of wrapped in blankets in the dark and listen to someone's soothing voice and just allow that rest and relax response to find its footing. But once my body had learned the relaxation response again, then what I found was I needed to explore some of the bigger structural societal issues that are driving all of this. Because if individual responses to collective problems only go so far, I can do a little bit to help myself, but we're much more powerful if we come together as a society and help make things better for everyone.
And, you know, I just want to add that when you have been under stress for a number of years, so, you know, you're in the broadcasting industry, which, you know, huge demands and constraints and pressures, and, you know, the environment is pretty toxic in those studios with all the lights and Wi-Fi, you know, just the whole career path. It took you years for your body to become so exhausted and, in a sense, dysfunctional. So we often think, well, okay, I'm dealing with anxiety and I have these symptoms, so I'm just going to rest for a little bit, a few weeks, a month, and I'll be fine again. But you don't realize that this has gone on for years and years and years. In some cases, you know, Tara, it's gone on since childhood. If people are dealing with stress and trauma in their lives, early in their lives. Yeah. So this is like this process that has been, it's like termites eating away at the foundation of our being. And it does take time to rebuild and regenerate the system. We get impatient and we don't fully appreciate how much our system has been compromised over the years. So it's like building a new house, in a sense.
Yeah, you're so right about that. It's a very slow process. I'm not a very patient person, and I was sort of amazed at how long it took to recover my equilibrium.
Yeah, well, I guess you're learning patience.
Especially at this particular moment in time.
Which is a gift, right? That's such a gift. You know, this is one of my favorite quotes I learned somewhere along the way that goes, patience is easy for those who trust.
Yeah, that's
a good one, right? Yeah, it's a good one. So, okay, before we go into the bigger societal things that are driving these conditions, can we talk about what you are observing and what you are suggesting to people at this time that we are facing so much uncertainty around our health, uncertainty around economics, uncertainty around what the picture will look like in our world when we emerge from this time. What are you suggesting to people? What are your strategies to help people deal with these uncertainties at this moment in our history?
Well, I'm really taking cues from the reporting that I'm doing and the things that I'm hearing from the experts that I speak to, and then passing that on to listeners. And what I've heard that has been super helpful, I interviewed an international securities expert a couple of weeks ago, and she has lived in disaster zones all over the world and has lived, you know, waking up to gunshots in the morning and living with cholera in your neighborhood and really quite significant threats. And what she said was super interesting. She said it's really good to know that there are stages to these kind of crises. And we are very much in the beginning stage. And so typically the beginning stage is marked by those sort of extreme fight or flight reactions that we were just speaking about a few minutes ago, that our bodies are flooded with adrenaline, that our reasoning faculties are shut down for a very good part, and that, you know, high-level cognitive tasks are difficult and concentration is difficult, and we become sort of obsessed with security, you know, the immediate survival of where do I get face masks and how do I disinfect my house and, you know, how can I safely go to the grocery store, and that we are living with this high, high level of vigilance. And it makes daily life very, very difficult. But that is a stage in this process, and that eventually, you know, depending on where you are in North America and where the virus is in terms of the curve, eventually your brain will adjust to the new normal. Our brains are incredibly resilient, that at some point you'll wake up one morning and your body won't be flooded with as much adrenaline. You will be able to sleep again, and you will be able to think deeply again, and that, you know, the brain will make that mental shift and your daily life will get easier. I found that message incredibly comforting. So that's one thing that I pass on all the time. Another thing that I pass on is in my research, I really learned a lot about where we come from. And, you know, we are a tribal, social species. We evolved on the savannas of Africa to live in small groups, to be incredibly interdependent. And our biology is wired for that, and so is our psychology. And so in these moments of incredible uncertainty, kindness and altruism and interdependence, you know, that reciprocity of giving and receiving, of caring for others, of being cared for, is extremely important and can do so much for our mental health. And so, you know, I often will mention all of the incredible things that that I've been hearing about reporting. You know, in my own neighborhood, a woman stepped up and organized our whole neighborhood and set up an email list and a Google Doc so that anyone who needed help could get it and anyone who wanted to give help could give it. And we had 70 people in this small block radius volunteer to get groceries and to call seniors who were feeling isolated and to pick up prescriptions for people. And that's incredibly, incredibly healing. That I think we've been in this self-help era for a long time. And that in a disaster, you can really see that what we need is physical, tangible help. We need to know that we are looked after on a practical, material basis, and that goes a long way emotionally. So those are the two pieces of advice that I give a lot right now, that this is a normal response to anxiety, to the conditions that we're living in, that it will pass, and that if you want to help yourself and help others, to look in your community to the places where you can form connections and to be of service.
So what you titled your book, Lean Out,
So is that part of what you are saying in your book? So let's talk about lean out, what the deeper meaning is.
So I read, like a lot of people, I read Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, and I found it made me very angry, and it took me a long time to figure out why it made me so angry. And I think part of it was that the message, her solution to women's empowerment was for all of us to be more ambitious, to, you know, take a seat at the table, to push for promotions, and to work until the moment we gave birth to children, if that was our path, and then get back to work immediately after. And I found that offensive on a number of levels. I don't define leadership just by the corporate class. I think that women are leaders in their communities. I think they're the glue that holds society together. If somebody is sick, if somebody's in crisis, it is more often than not the women who will step in and provide that support. And that is a form of leadership. And I know men do that as well, but I think women are more socialized to do that, and I think we play that role really beautifully in society. So I think that is a form of leadership, and it's one that needs to be acknowledged. The second thing that I really had a problem with there is the response of work harder, push harder, make more money, achieve more is really the ideological driver of capitalism. And I don't think the manifestation that we're in right now of late-stage capitalism is really serving us very well at all. And so I really questioned the ethos that she was pushing there. I mean, on a practical level, we've seen professionals all over North America lose a lot of the labor gains that we had gained in decades leading up to this. I mean, there is an epidemic of unpaid overtime happening all over North America. So many professionals that I know work 60, 70 hours a week and are paid $0 and 0 cents for those extra 10, 20, 30 hours a week that they work. So I had a problem with all of those things. And the last thing that I really questioned was this idea that is very common in our society right now, that you have these huge structural inequalities and that you put the emphasis on the individual to solve their own pain that results from these inequalities. And so it's a double burden for those that are exploited. They are experiencing the sort of crushing realities of the system, and then they are told that their own pain over those crushing realities is then their job to solve. And so I found that book really epitomized a lot of the trends that we're seeing and a lot of the trends that had negatively impacted my own life. And so the title of my book is in opposition to all of that.
Well, that's quite a lot. It sounds like you have gone through a profound transformation from the events that initiated these changes to where you are now. It just sounds like it's forced you to reevaluate your life, your choices, your behaviors, and bigger issues as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely it has. And you know from what you said that anytime you have one of those real kind of awakenings that it sounds like for you as well as for me has impacted absolutely every area of my life. And what is very satisfying for me in the moment that we're in right now is I think the natural impulse when you've had one of these transformations is to share, is to want to give and to share and to support others. And during this crisis, what's been really just satisfying for me personally is that the work that I'm doing right now, I am covering the pandemic. It is around the clock work is very difficult sometimes. Some of the reporting is basically disaster reporting. It's very emotionally taxing, and I'm finding that I have the stamina for it and that I, as a result of the transformation that I have been through, have a real clear sense of purpose and contribution, and that is helping me not just on an emotional level, but actually on a physical level as well.
Well, I would hope so, Tara. I hope that you would, after everything you went through, you would be able to incorporate more strategies and be more resilient. So I'm just curious, what are the things you do for yourself? Because I think that would really help people who are listening in, who are dealing with, you know, equal kinds of stressors. What are you personally doing to maintain your sense of balance, health, and sanity in a career that's still very stressful, especially with all that's happening?
Yeah, so on a practical level, I have found that walking is really, really helpful for me. That has become kind of a walking meditation. I do that every day, and I find that being in nature is incredibly helpful. And there's all kinds of science around that, but I think just on the level of well-being, you know, this morning I was out for a walk. It was raining. All the buds are starting to come out here. There's flowers. The air kind of smelled like flowers, and all of the just luscious, luscious green around me really lifted my spirit. And we know from the research on forest bathing that there is all kinds of evidence that being in nature helps with everything from concentration and confusion to mood to immunity. So nature helps me so much. Walking helps me so much. Getting 8 or 9, sometimes even 10 hours of sleep a night helps me tremendously, particularly with processing the stress of the day. So those three things are really foundational for me. Nourishing food is incredibly important. I'm doing a lot of cooking right now, cooking from scratch, eating really nice when I available local food if I can get it. And then, of course, and this is the tricky one, all of those things help a lot, but nothing helps as much as social connection. Again, on the theme that we are a tribal social species, you know, I am living right now in a house with friends, and so I'm very lucky that I can sit down with people for dinner every night, but I have at different points in my life have had to go through some of these kinds of difficult moments on my own. And so if you're listening and you're alone, some of the things I did to mitigate that isolation and give myself a sense of connection was to listen to podcasts, to listen to the radio. Podcasts and radio are so intimate, and the content often really has to do with that sort of deep soul level connection. And so those things helped me a lot. Long phone calls with friends helped me a lot. Learning how to ask for help when I needed it. We live in a very individual society. Sometimes I have to ask several people before I got the support I needed, but that was critical, asking for help. So, yeah, all of those things I continue to use and employ every single day in this crisis. And also, like I said, that big mental shift of understanding that you know, part of my salvation lives in contributing to the greater good, and to try and tie all of my actions to that idea of the greater good and to what we all need in a moment in time, and not just me.
Exactly. You know, I'm calling this time our sacred space. I've been listening to some other podcasts, like you said, and one person said, you know, a year from now, you're going to wish you were back in quarantine because it's time out, right? Some time to reflect, time to be creative. It truly, I guess, you know, for me, this time has been really creative. Of course, I'm used to working on my own. I work in my own space. So it hasn't been that dramatic and traumatic for me because I kind of just do what I've always done, right? But What I am encouraging people to do is take this time to do things to connect with themselves. So learn a little meditation, or go online and learn a little yoga or breathing exercises. Learn something. You know, there are these free language programs that you can do, which I'm doing with Spanish. and I've also been doing some creative things, you know, just dabbling, making cards and doing, you know, sprinkly stuff. And I don't know. I just feel like I want to do something that's fun that I've never done before. So I am doing these creative card making experiences, or learning to play my Native American flute, which I have sitting here and I've never really learned how to do. This is a moment that we can take a breath. I mean, I'm on my own. I don't have a family. I don't have lots of kids. And all the stress that goes on with having to entertain children, with dealing with that confined space, with family, with partner. But it still is an opportunity for people to find some sacred space of their own and make the most. I mean, this is what's going on. This is where we're at. So sitting and complaining and yearning and fretting isn't going to change anything. So we have to change ourselves, right? This is the time. Change ourselves, open up to new possibilities while we are here where we are. And it's probably a good suggestion for any time of change in our lives. You can't change the events that are going on, but you can change how you perceive them and what you do with that space that's occurring right now.
I think about it a little differently than you do in terms of the idea that we can't change things. I totally understand where you're coming from on that, but I actually think there's a lot of things that we can change and that we have a responsibility to change. And so I think in this moment, while we're all going within, I think it's also very important to look around without as well and to look at, I mean, this virus has been the great revealer. It has showed us the places in our society that are not working. And that, you know, as I had mentioned before, that really extreme income inequality that is causing so much problems all over society. One of the things that I found really astonishing in my research was anytime you have a big gap between the rich and the poor, like you do in the United States and in Canada right now, every measure of society plummets. So I'm talking about everything from teen pregnancies to illiteracy to infant mortality to obesity to mental illness, addiction, and but not just those things, also physical health. Everybody's physical health suffers across the income spectrum, including the wealthy. So, you know, this virus is showing us the ways in which our society is not functioning properly. And I think it would be a shame if in this moment of pause, we didn't also look at that bigger picture. And that I think that there are a lot of people in our own neighborhoods who are really, really suffering right now, and that it's an opportunity for us to reach out to those people, to start coming together as a community, to start re-envisioning how we all live together, to acknowledge our interconnectedness and then find actions from that place. And that I think there's a lot we actually can change. So that would be my thought on that while we're taking this time to pause, while we're turning within, that we also look without and see what we can do on our own communities in sort of a tangible way.
Absolutely. I agree. I don't think we disagree at all on that point. I think that it's causing us to look at many areas of our lives and what's important for us. And certainly this time really opens our hearts, that allows us to, you know, reach out and support and serve other people in whatever way we can. You know, and if, you know, for families, and, you know, it's reaching out to organizations or other groups that are supporting children and dealing with kids and learning. I think we have to. We're forced to, because we can't distract ourselves much more anymore with this situation, right? So we're looking and we're observing and we're seeing where there is pain or suffering, difficulty. So hopefully that is what's going on. You know, you talk about income inequality. You know, I'm a very rich and very poor. I can hardly think of any country that doesn't have income inequality in the world. Can you?
Yeah, there are countries that do much better with it than we do in North America. There's a great team of researchers out of the UK who have written a couple of books on this, and they compare all over the globe. And there is an index, and it shows kind of different gradients of income inequality. And so some of the Scandinavian countries do much better with income inequality. Japan does much better with income inequality, and there's different ways that they get there. They either redistribute resources through taxes, or they have caps on CEO salaries. So there's different ways of doing it. They're all tested in rich market democracies all over the world. They're all in capitalist models. Just other countries make more of a priority for having equality than Canada and the U.S. does.
Well, I would, yeah, I mean, UK, Australia, probably other EU countries, South America, Africa. I mean, there's, you know, the systems themselves have led to this huge, you know, separation and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I agree, you know, somehow these systems are not sustainable. So how that's going to unfold, how our culture is going to change, I do believe this is a time of a huge reset. I don't quite know what it's going to look like. I don't know how difficult it's going to be. But it certainly is a time of huge change, and it's like we've arrived at a demarcation point in our history where things are not going to be the way they were. We don't quite know what we're moving into, but we have to implement what we've been talking about. First of all, we have to implement our own resilience. We have to implement the tools, the strategies that keep us in a place of staying centered and balanced, of understanding how by choosing our thoughts. Someone made this statement that I really like, and they said, fear and faith have something in common. So fear and faith have something in common, and what they have in common is that they are anticipating the unknown, right? So I love that because you can anticipate the unknown with fear and anxiety and thoughts that are moving in that direction, or you can anticipate the future from that place of faith where you see positive outcomes, where you imagine, it's just get into the imaginary realm, imagine what it's like to be supported, imagine what it's like to have solutions arrive. Imagine how you can be given greater health and guidance in your life. So one will bring you a greater sense of peace because you're having more mastery over the kinds of thoughts you want to have and kinds of thoughts you have, determine what is going on in your body. The other way of thinking, as you were explaining, is stressful, fearful thoughts actually shut down the body, shut down the body's ability to have healthy growth of cells and systems working, and kind of generates more of that anxiety because in fear, like you were saying, you're highly focused on excessive thinking of fear. So that to me is part of this journey that we're on right now, and then it's, you know, being open to how we can make our society different, how we can move forward in the days and weeks and months and years ahead, right? Just to like uncovering more of what's really been going on and maybe waking up to things that we haven't been aware of before.
I think in terms of the thought processes, I am less concerned with that in my own work and more concerned with sort of the concrete conditions of living. And I think that, I think, of course, the thought processes are important. But I also think that the sort of flip side of that is when our focus becomes just controlling our thinking, for me, I lose sight of sort of the biology of it sometimes. And I think that I have found a lot of comfort in understanding that there's a lot of the sort of biological responses that, that I maybe can't control with my thinking. Like one of the research pieces in my book that, that really surprised me was that when you are lonely and isolated, that they can measure that by the amount of micro-awakenings that you have in the night. And that's a completely biological process. You're unconscious. And basically, the reason they think that that happens is that on the savannas of Africa, if you were separated from your tribe in the night, you would be in grave danger. You'd be in danger for predators. You'd be in danger for attacks from other tribes. You'd be vulnerable to the weather. And so you would have to be incredibly hypervigilant. You'd have to wake up over and over and over again to ensure your safety. And similarly, when people are isolated and feeling lonely, that you can measure the cortisol levels in their saliva. And that in some instances, being isolated and lonely like that is actually more stressful on the body than being attacked by a stranger. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I think a lot of what's going on here is bigger than the individual. It's biology, it's psychology, it's society. And for me, I found a lot of comfort in understanding that those big kind of forces were at work, and to instead kind of look to the external conditions and how can I contribute to changing the external conditions. So if I'm lonely, how can I get in front of other people? If I am suffering from the injustice in society, how can I contribute to ending that injustice? For me, I found that less, kind of elusive. I found it more pragmatic, more straightforward, more easy to pursue that solution. So I found that, you know, trying to work with my own thoughts often left me frustrated. And, you know, it may be every person has their own path towards this, but for me, I found that the concrete action really helped me so much more.
So have you? So it sounds like in your path that the change that went on has either strengthened, maybe initiated or strengthened your desire for social activism. I mean, it sounds like that this is really important for you in your life and to contribute to that. Have you always been like that, or was that part of this transformation that you went through?
I think it has always been in my mind, for sure. I've always, as a reporter, been interested in those kinds of stories and have paid a lot of attention to that side of life. But I think for me, it doesn't necessarily have to be political. I mean, one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to figure out ways that I could get more of that social, human, deep connection with others. And a lot of the ways that I pursued in terms of building community didn't actually have to do with activism or politics at all. I mean, I went to my coffee shop every day, even when I was depressed or when I was anxious, and I would get to know the baristas in my coffee shop, and they're just lovely, lovely human beings. And it was kind of like a town square in the neighborhood I was living in that people gathered there every day, and they had spontaneous conversations, and they met their neighbors, and community formed, and they, you know, might share food from their garden, or I would often bring in, I was reviewing books at the time, so I got sent big bags of books, and after I finished reading them, I would take them into the baristas, and they would read them, we would have conversations about what they were reading, and, you know, which led to conversations about their lives, which led to these deep bonds, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those people. And so from there, I went and began volunteering at a high school for at-risk youth in my neighborhood. And one of my tasks was to help them with English essays. So I would interview them on my iPhone, and then I would type up the transcript, and then we would fashion that into a story. And hearing about their lives was so powerful for me. And they were just really remarkable young people with so much tenacity and so much hope, and really kind of special, unique individuals. And from there, I became an organizer in a cycling club and met a ton of people that were already living in my neighborhood. I just hadn't had access to them before, and we formed some really deep bonds in that way. And I also befriended some of the homeless guys on my block and got to know their stories. And so for me, definitely so right that I have a very strong kind of political conscience that is growing and growing as does this sort of process grow and grow for me. But for those out there who maybe don't have that bent, I think that all of those examples that I just gave show that even if social justice is not necessarily your interest, that getting to know your neighbors can be such a rich and powerful and rewarding experience and can really change your life in quite profound ways.
I love that story, Tara. I love the fact that this journey that you've been on has allowed you to just open and expand and explore and connect in ways you didn't even have time for before, right? Right? So it's like you have to stop. And maybe that's part of the message you're sharing. It's like, now that we stop, we have more time. How can we reach out? What are the ways we can support people in our local communities? At this time and as we move forward, it makes us more aware that there's been a lot of people who've been suffering. So, these stories are wonderful. I love the fact that you created your community out of your little coffee shop. So when they open up again, right, and appreciate them, but serving other people. I mean, that's the message. It's serving others. That's part of this journey. That's part of this awakening. It's how can we serve others? I'd say all of my spiritual teachers have had the same message. I think all spiritual teachers have the same message, and that is the purpose of life is to serve. Mm-hmm. We're here to serve. Our greatest satisfaction. I mean, all those things that you did opened your heart more, right? Your heart was opened, and the more you opened your heart, the more when you interacted with others, they were opening their hearts and inspiring them to find ways that they could serve and give to others. It's such a chain reaction, right?
Oh, you're so right. And the despair piece in all of this, that was what lifted me out of the despair, was exactly that. That was what solved the despair, and the despair has not come back since then. So that was the most powerful thing in terms of the depression that I was experiencing was that cycle. And you make a really good point about time, because time is finite, and I did not have, when I worked 12 hours a day, and, was rushing around the rest of the time to get food and take care of the basics of life. And I did not have the time that it took to build those kinds of relationships. And those relationships are really now are what are buffering me from the stress of covering a global pandemic. Mm. Those relationships are what are keeping me strong. But those relationships were built with time and with energy and with investment and, as you say, with openness. And I think you make such a good point about the opening, because I found it very difficult in the early stages of to open up to all of that. I felt self-conscious. I was worried about coming across as needy. I mean, all the range of emotions. It was very difficult for me to open up myself up to that. And it took energy and it took time and it was definitely something that required attention, and I didn't have that attention when I was working 12 hours a day. And I think when you talk about the moment that we're in, we are all increasing our attention. We have energy for things that we no longer had energy, or sorry, that we did not have energy for 2 or 3 months ago, and that whatever change comes from all of this, I think it's going to come from that piece.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, because, in your journey, as I'm listening to you, I mean, you just had a profound initiation, right? You were initiated to waking. It's like you woke up. Some part of you came, it was, through this this journey that you went through and the fear, and it's like you stopped, and there's a moment that just allowed you to expand your heart, expand your consciousness. And out of that, so many things have changed in your life. And you wrote this book. You're out having conversations like this today, helping people to understand how they too can move through times of difficulties and stress and know that there's more waiting for them.
We are really all in this together. And I think one of the big gifts of this whole process is thinking about life in those terms. And like you said, thinking about all of us all over the world going through this together, all of us coming to terms with this very startling reality all together, and all of us looking for ways that we can all contribute and that we can support our neighbors and that we can give the best of ourselves to others as well.
Absolutely. So in the last couple of minutes we have, Tara, do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share?
You know, I think I'd like to just sort of pass on some of the messages of hope that I've been getting in my reporting. I'm just finding the things that people are doing during this crisis to be absolutely remarkable. I'm thinking about here in Toronto, CEOs who are grocery market CEOs who have volunteered to work on the front line stocking shelves. I'm thinking about another CEO of a healthcare network that I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, who our long-term care facilities are in very, very dire situations. And that whole healthcare network led, I think it's about 70 volunteers, doctors and nurses and psychiatrists and personal support workers going into these long-term care homes and bathing and feeding and toileting the residents and giving the staff much, much needed support. I'm thinking about, you know, all of the food banks here in Toronto that are so deluged with need right now, and donations from the community are pouring in, and it's sort of all hands on deck to get the food out to the community. And then on a structural level, I'm seeing there is huge shifts happening in the culture. We are aware of and respecting the contributions of our frontline workers, our bus drivers, and our grocery store clerks, and our nurses. And in Canada here, in the province that I'm in, there is now free daycare 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for our frontline workers to support them. There is a universal basic income introduced for people who have lost their livelihood in this pandemic. And there's just this incredible groundswell of support for citizens all across the spectrum. We're seeing our homeless population move to hotels and giving shelter, and they're building temporary modular housing here to make sure that our homeless population are able to recover from the virus for those that are sick and to avoid it for those who are not. We're just seeing absolutely remarkable things happening. And so I feel so much hope right now in humanity, and I feel very heartened by what I'm seeing. I know it's a very difficult time for a lot of people. I know people are dealing with illness and uncertainty and financial insecurity, but I just want people to know also the good that's happening right now. And it really is incredible, and I hope we all can participate in it.
Well, that is uplifting, and it seems like because of the shift that you made in your focus, and you're getting an opportunity to do these interviews that just reinforce and expand and inspire these possibilities now. So how wonderful for you, Tara, right? You're out there and reporting the good news, in a sense.
Thank you. And I mean, you do also have to do difficult stories too, and those are very difficult to do. But there's a lot good going on as well right now too.
And it's making sure that those good stories get out there, because they help to counteract the effect of listening to sad stories, right? We have to be able to. That's part of the challenge to keep ourselves healthy We have to be uplifted and inspired, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we've come to the end of this wonderful conversation. Thank you, Tara. Tara Henley has been my guest today. So the best, first of all, I definitely recommend people pick up a copy of Tara's book called Lean Out. Is it like an Amazon, best place to go, Amazon or Barnes & Noble?
Yes, you can definitely find it on Amazon, yeah.
Okay, good. And then you were saying it's your Twitter handle. That's the best place to find you since you don't have a website. So that is Tara, T-A-R-A. Is it R?
And then R, and then my last name, E-T-N-L.
Okay, so it's Tara, T-A-R-A, R, letter R, Henley, H-E-N-L-E-Y. And you can follow Tara and what she's doing and continue to be inspired by her wonderful work and transformation. So, Tara, thanks so much for your time and sharing your inspiring story. And it's a story of inspiration and upliftment for all of us. So thank you so much. It's a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thank you for having me. We really enjoyed speaking with you.
My pleasure. And thank you, all my listeners, for joining in once again. And remember, check out my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, or my website, Dr. Cheryl Selman. Join me every week. And I hope you fill your week with peace, love, and harmony. Bye for now.